Hello, welcome to Sonic Tonic. I'm Greg Perret, and I'm extending a very warm welcome to all of you who are listening. I'll be bringing you music, interviews, and special features from the world of jazz and blues. This podcast is brought to you by the California Jazz Foundation. It's a nonprofit that assists California musicians who have given their lives to this music but have fallen on rough times. Our podcast will reflect the talent, the journeys, and the insights of a wide range of musical artists. So sit back, relax, and enjoy a Sonic Tonic. This Sonic Tonic episode is entitled Brush Man. It refers to the unparalleled skill and artistry of Clayton Cameron, the world-renowned drummer, percussionist, and composer. He's also active as a producer, historian, and educator, and recently became a board member of the California Jazz Foundation, a very welcome addition to that organization, I might add. I did this interview with him on February 8th of 2021, and I must say it was a delight to talk to my good friend. So get ready to hear some great jazz, some great stories from a great guy. But before I get into this interview, I'm going to start off with a Clayton Cameron composition entitled Artful. It supports the saying, a picture is worth a thousand words. And in this case, what you're going to hear speaks volumes to his amazing talent. We'll be right back. Hey, Clayton, it's Greg. How you doing?
Hey, Greg, I'm doing good.
Oh, man, it's good to talk to you. You know, I was reading up on your biographical stuff, and a couple of things struck me. One was that it seems we share a very similar path in terms of being here in L.A., working around the same artists, and getting our start at Henry Grant's music studio.
Oh, absolutely. You know, when my parents got me a drum set when I was 12.
Yeah.
And my mom insisted that I take drum lessons because the family had a past history of me getting instruments and never taking lessons. And then, you know, nothing would come of it.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess my dad, he had spoken to a neighbor who used to be a musician, you know, he was retired.
Mm-hmm.
And I jammed with him one day when I was about, you know, 11 years old or 10 years old. And he told my dad that, you know, I had some talent and you should get him some drums. And so one day I, you know, came home and there was a drum set in the house. I was just like, you know, and so I, my mom said, oh no, she wasn't opposed to the drums, but she says, you're not going to be just banging on those drums. You're going to be taking some lessons. So she started taking me up to Henry Grant's, and it was Raymond Pounds was my teacher. And it was like, from what I remember, $7 a half an hour lesson, you know, and then I got, you know, once I got to be, you know, I was 12, and then I think once I turned 13, my mom and dad just let me catch the bus up there.
You know, I've got a big smile on my face right now. A, I love Raymond Pounds. He's one of my dearest friends and a great drummer.
Oh, yeah.
And B, Henry sold me my first serious amp. It was a Standell. It was big as a house. I mean, there should be a monument to that guy. He helped so many inner city musicians.
Yeah, he really did. You know, my first time ever playing with a big band was at Henry Grant's. After my lesson, sometimes they'd be rehearsing and I'd stop in and just be all full of awe watching these guys and going, wow, how do they even know how to do that? How do you know this and that? And I don't even remember who used to play drums for the rehearsal band. But one day I went in and Gil Askey was doing the band.
Yeah, my old boss with Diana Ross.
Yeah, yeah. He was rehearsing the band and the drummer wasn't there, whoever it was supposed to be. And Gil said, do you play drums? And I was like, I wanted to say no, because I was like, I hope he's not asking me to come up. I didn't know how to read charts at the time. Mm-hmm. I knew how to read notes and rhythms.
Yeah.
But I knew nothing about interpretation. And so I sat down behind the drums and Gil counted it off. I think maybe I was trying to play a swing beat, but I was totally petrified looking at as a music. I had no idea what you were supposed to do. And so Gil came over and said, get up off those drums. And he took the sticks from me and he sat down. And I remember I was just to his right and he's looking back at me over his rimmed glasses. He said, now, when you play drums, and I'm looking at his hands, they look terrible. You know, like, that's not the way you hold sticks. You know, oh, what's he doing? You know, and so, but when he started playing, he said, when you play drums, you got to have attitude. And I was like, man, this guy sounds better than me, and he doesn't even have any technique, you know? And so that just changed. I mean, that was just like one of the best lessons I ever got on drums.
Well, Gil could be really rough around the edges, but he had a great heart and he was a great mentor.
Yeah.
When I did the Diana Ross Lady Sings the Blues tour, he was a conductor. And during that time, we became good friends and he taught me a lot.
Mm-hmm.
He was definitely old school, coming up the hard way, doing gig after miserable gig. But for him, the band was there to entertain the crowd.
Mm-hmm.
And as a player, you had to bring it.
Right, right.
Yeah, I love that guy. He was no nonsense.
Yeah, absolutely. And I visited him when he was living in Australia too. Yeah.
Yes, it does seem we traveled a similar path and did work with a lot of the same people. I worked with Sammy Davis Jr. for a summer, but it seems like you had a nice long run with him and that gig for you was transformative.
Yeah, absolutely. I just wish that young people that I see that have, you know, attitude or they're all this and that, kind of full of themselves, kind of like the culture. If they could have just hung out with Sammy for a little bit and watched his work ethic, you know, the way he treated an audience and the way he brought it to the audience.
Yeah, you know, there is a different landscape out there. I have to say, though, I do hate it, though, when, you know, people go, well, you know, back in my day, I don't want to go there. Yeah, I don't think it's relevant to this conversation, but I'm glad you're bringing this up. So, okay, yeah. I mean, there are these new ways of learning, and they're called YouTube University or Google University, where things are learned virtually and not experienced physically.
Right.
I think so many young artists don't realize that, and it's my opinion, they're dealing with two completely different art forms, the recording arts and the performing arts.
Right.
In the recording arts, there's so many other factors that influence the recording that you don't find in the performing arts. Mm. Off the bat, if you screw up, you can do another take or fix it in Pro Tools mm-hmm. or Logic or whatever waveform editing platform one is using.
Yeah.
Also, more often than not, the producer, engineer, agent, manager, I mean, they're all there and they're all putting in their 2 cents. Yeah, you and I come from that live gig place where if you screw up, you can't go back and do a retake.
Right, right.
And one doesn't have the peanut gallery stepping in to tell you what's right or wrong. That said, I have been yelled at on many a bandstand.
And then just the idea of the human side of it, you know, yes. like when you're going on YouTube and all that, I have seen some kids that have just phenomenal technique and all that kind of stuff, but not necessarily adept at playing music.
Ah, good point. Well said.
And then at the same time, when you're learning from YouTube and you're, you know, kind of picking out the stuff that you really like and, you know, which is all fantastic.
Right.
You know, no one's there to pull in the reins and say, hey, just play X, Y, Z.
Right.
You know, one year I had the pleasure of playing behind James Brown at the Hollywood Bowl.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. I knew he could, like Ray Charles, could be really tough on drummers, you know. And in fact, Christian McBride, who hired me, said, you know, Clayton, you know, Mr. Brown's probably not going to like anything you play. You know, he's hard on drummers. And I heard that before. And so
sure.
So I called up a few buddies, you know, that I knew had played with James Brown. One was Steve Jordan. When he was on Letterman's show, James Brown came on there a few times. And mm-hmm. I talked to him. But the real conversation I had was with jazz drummer Bill Stewart.
Oh, okay.
I was in New York, and I knew he was playing at the 55 Bar with Mike Stern. So I said, let me go by there and ask him about his James Brown experience. I said, did you play with James Brown? He said, one time. He holds up his finger, one time. And I said, well, what happened? He said, Mr. Brown counted off the tempo. You know, we started playing. He said, I don't think we got past two bars. And he stopped me and said, drummer, your hands come up too high to play my music. So, I said, okay. I said, my hands will not be coming up high. But, you know, it made sense because, you know, James Brown was actually a drummer and he's coming from more obviously old school guys that there wasn't a whole lot of big arm movement and stuff. It was a lot of finesse and stuff. And so it only made sense. And so when I went to go play with him, we were at the bowl and basically the show was a recreation of a record that he did, but never performed live called Soul on Top.
Right.
And so it's a jazz record. You know, he had called up Louis Belson
right.
and said, Louis, I want to do a jazz record. Can you put the band together? You know, so he got Ray Brown and Oliver Nelson to do the arrangements, all-star band and all that. And so they recorded, you know, a really great record. And so tunes like Every Day I Have the Blues, he did that. But the tune that I really focused on was September. See, oh, it's a long, long time from May to December.
Great song.
On there, Louis Belson played this kind of like boogaloo beat. Mm-hmm. You know, that was like with the jazz musician's version of what the rock and roll guys would do. You know, right. it was like two different camps, you know. It's not right. as blended as it is today. Before it was like, you know, two separate things. But anyway, so I said, well, I'm not going to play that. So I just came up with a little groove, you know. During rehearsal, they called the tune. I was like, okay, here's the moment of truth. Because that was the only thing that had a backbeat, you know, that would be considered kind of like funky, right? So I had brought a special snare drum that I tuned a certain way, and I put that up. And then they counted off the tune. Mr. Brown had the pickup, you know, oh, do, do, bam, you know.
Right.
So we broke into the tune. You know, so I play in the groove. You know, we get to the finish the tune. And so James Brown turns around and I was like, oh, he goes, now that was funky. Oh, I died and went to heaven. That's like one of the top five things in my life.
And you got it from the master.
I'm telling you, I was like, listen, no one can talk to me. I don't care if I never play another backbeat in life. I got it from that guy and I'm just going to take it.
Yeah, to me, this gets back to what we were talking about earlier. You know, the dynamics of a live performance, not dependent on technology.
Right.
but instead the investment of a person's talent in real time.
Yes.
Now, here you've been hired to play with James Brown, playing these tunes from the American Songbook as interpreted by James Brown, but not written by him.
Right.
And performed by a whole slew of musicians from the jazz world. Now, you and I both know this could be a total train wreck or a glorious journey.
Right, right.
I don't know. That's why live performance is so exciting to me.
Mm-hmm.
Getting the variety of so many human perspectives and all in the moment. You know, there's no going back.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and variety is the key word, too, because it's, first of all, even if it's in the same genre, artists are so different, you know.
Yes, exactly.
And they ask for different things. I remember Betty Carter, I never worked with her.
Yeah.
She came to a show, maybe it was with Tony Bennett, probably in the 80s. So she came to a show probably with Sammy, and she said, "How did I miss you?" Like that, right? And man, I had seen what Lewis Nash had gone through, one of my favorite drummers. Those legends, those people who were like laying down a pathway, including Sammy, you know.
Oh, yeah.
She was the kind of vocalist that would say, you know, "You need to bring it. You know, that's what you did last night. What you got tonight?" You know, that sort of thing. While somebody else might be like, "Just give me the same thing," you know?
Yeah.
The idea of being versatile and realizing that you can't walk into every situation the same. You know, these days, maybe you can play, you know, a part exactly right, like it was programmed. And that's, you know, that's cool.
Mm-hmm.
And it'll be the same way every time. And some artists don't want that. Even James Brown, when he did the show with us, or we did the show with him at the Hollywood Bowl,
mm-hmm.
one of his sons told me, he says, "Man, Pops is very happy, man." Because he was doing something different. When James Brown first came into the rehearsal, we were on a sound stage over at Center Stage. You know, so we had the big band on one side. Well, we had two drum sets. Louis Belson was going to play one song, which was fantastic. And so we had about 19 guys, right?
Wow, yeah.
James Brown's side, on the other side of the sound stage facing us, I mean, they must have had about 25 people, you know, because they had two percussionists and two drummers and, you know, saxophonists, the, you know, the dancers and, you know, horns, you know, it was just like, it was amazing. And so finally Mr. Brown arrived. And so he looked up and, you know, saw the big band, and he was like, okay, well, let's get this thing started. So first thing we did was Every Day We Had the Blues. I don't think that it really varied from that, you know, that Joe Williams arrangement it did with Basie. You know, I don't know if that was Q or Quincy Jones's arrangement, but I think it was like pretty much the same thing. So, you know, started off with those horns. Da di di da di da 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 to see what Mr. Brown's reaction was going to be. So, you know, it was the first thing we did, you know. We hadn't done a thing. It was the first tune of the rehearsal. He's sitting on a bar stool with his head down. And so we're all quiet. Everybody, the two bands and the people on the side. I mean, you can hear a pin drop. And he looks up, he goes, "Wow." He says, "That brings back a lot of memories." And then he had his head down again. And he looked up, he said, "I just made a detour with the funk." Just made a detour with the funk. Now, this was a really, really poignant moment. No one knew whether to laugh, but he was serious. Wow, you know, he was back to his roots again.
Yeah.
You know, and this is where he started. And it brought back a lot of memories for him before, you know, he became famous and really started, you know, doing his thing.
Right.
And that kind of goes back also to doing the same thing every night. And kind of getting away from wherever you started, you know?
Yeah, I know. I know exactly what you mean. So I'm going to switch directions. Now that we're into this interview, I feel it's a good time to bring up the fact that in the drumming community, you are considered a master and a pioneer when it comes to playing with brushes. What's fascinating to me is that to hit a drum with a stick and then with a brush couldn't be more different. What got you to this place of being a master at both?
Well, you know, it started with fear. I heard that, you know, if you wanted to be a good drummer, man, you had to know how to play brushes. I don't know where I heard it from, but I heard it. And so there was a big turning point in my life when I was in college and I was rehearsing with a pianist, Vanessa Brown.
Oh, yeah.
and saxophonist Carl Jones.
Okay, yeah. Know them both.
Yeah, and I don't remember who was playing bass, and I don't remember who was for. Mm-hmm. What I remember from that day is they were playing a ballad, and I said, oh, yeah, I'll pull out my brushes. You know, so I started swishing around and just trying to stay out of the way. And that was my attitude. I'm going to stay out of the way. I don't want to mess up anything. And so Carl Jones changed my life with a comment that he made after we finished the tune. He looked at me and just said one sentence, you should take brushes more seriously. I was like, oh, man, I thought I was doing okay. And so then I started really listening to records. And what's kind of strange about the brushes, Greg, is that I would ask different drummers that were older than me, including, you know, a couple of my old teachers. They would go, oh, yeah, do this. This is what you do. Is that it? You know, I couldn't imagine that that was it, that what he just showed me, that one thing,
right,
was all I needed to know. And so it set me on a quest to listening to everybody that I could live so I could see what they were doing, try to decipher what they're doing on records and all that sort of stuff. So after I graduated from college, I ended up getting a gig in Las Vegas playing with a fantastic pianist by the name of Kirk Stewart. We had a trio gig inside the Desert Inn Hotel. We would play 3 45-minute sets a night, but they were spread out over the evening. So like you may start at 9 and not finish until 2 in the morning.
Yeah.
Each night we played, there was a red light that we could see if the band got too loud.
Mm-hmm.
You were not there for the entertainment purposes. You were there for those people who had lost all their money and they got a drink ticket and they can go over,
yes,
and listen to the band, right?
I know what you're talking about.
So with that said, we never were to distract from the tables.
Oh, yeah.
You know, when I first got a gig, I would try to play sticks. And then you get, oh, man, it's too loud. It's too loud. Oh, my God. Then you get a smaller stick. Then you get a flat ride cymbal. And it was always too loud. Now, I had the gig for 8 months. So I say about after the first month of trying to play with sticks, I completely gave them up altogether.
Uh-huh.
I only played brushes for 7 months.
Wow.
So if you ask me to play with some sticks, my hands would be like rubber. You become atrophic. So anyway, so I did that, and then I got with Sammy Davis Jr. So now I go from that to playing in a big band.
Right.
You know, Sammy was just such a turning point in my life because he was such a huge star, but he was such a generous man. Generous in the sense that, you know, I was a young guy, and he hired me.
Yeah.
You know, and I made mistakes, and he said, see you tomorrow night. You know?
Oh, yeah, look, I had the same experience with him. Great guy.
There was a night that I had, or 2 weeks I had an epiphany. We were playing at the Bally's Hotel, and it was right after Sammy had finished wrapping a movie with Gregory Hines called Tap.
Oh, yeah.
It's a movie that people should see if they wanted to see some tap dancers. You know, the plot is, you know, it's okay. But, man, the artistry in the movie is fantastic. After that movie wrapped, and I had gone to the set a couple of times in L.A. and, you know, saw these, you know, a couple of things they were shooting and all that. To my total enjoyment, three of the tap dancers from the movie joined Sammy Davis in the show that he was doing with Jerry Lewis.
Mm-hmm.
And this is how great Sammy was. He didn't mind giving it up. So he was doing the show with Jerry Lewis, and they had this little bit where they would trade fours in tap dancing during the opening number.
Mm-hmm.
Sammy would do his thing, and Jerry Lewis would do the Nutty Professor tap dance, right? And so Sammy would say, you know, Jerry, what are you doing? You know, well, I'm tap dancing. You know, and Sammy says, man, that's not tap dancing. I'll show you tap dancing. So he gestures over to stage right, and out come Bunny Briggs, Arthur Duncan, and Sandman Sims, three hoofers, you know?
Oh, yeah.
For 2 weeks, we had a gig at Bally's. So I got to watch these guys and keep time behind them for 2 weeks.
Oh, yeah.
I watched how Bunny Briggs would do these rapid-fire taps and barely move his upper body. It was all about his feet. And, you know, it was just, like, amazing. And Sandman Sims slip-sliding his taps. Arthur Duncan coming out using his toe and his heel and all of that.
Mm.
So every night, I would go back. I listened to their combinations. And then I would go back and try to play those combinations with my brushes. You know, Sandman is sliding, so the brushes slide.
Mm-hmm.
So all the different sounds that they were getting out of their feet, I would go back and try to emulate in my, you know, hotel room.
Mm-hmm.
And man, I would be up all night doing this, Greg. I mean, I would be up all friggin' night trying to go, what was that the Sandman did? What, you know, and I didn't have a cell phone where you could record it, or, you know, you had to try to memorize what they did. And so I remember one night, probably during the second week, I went into the tap dancer's dressing room. Bunny Briggs was sitting down and Sandman was in there. Arthur Duncan hadn't arrived yet. Brought in my little pad and my brushes. I said, Bunny, this is something I heard you do the other night. And so I played it for him. Actually, I just played it on the counter. And he looked at me sitting down and looked up at me. He goes, baby boy, he said, you got it in your hands and we got it in our feet.
What a compliment.
Greg, it would take me about, I kid you not, probably about 3 to 4 years before I was able to develop the techniques in order to emulate what they were doing.
Gotcha.
And then also to be able to play in time with combinations like they did, where it made sense.
Yeah.
And it wasn't just about, you know, oh, he's doing some tricks,
right?
You know, because I was here, I heard everything I wanted to do before I could do it because of them.
Mm.
Then I developed these techniques that hadn't been done before, because I was like, okay, how do I get that sound? If I do this and that, oh yeah, that works, you know? Yeah, then I remember, you know, I would go to a gig or something and try something and totally screw up. You know? And so it took some time before it started all coming, you know, coming together. But like I said, I was hearing the stuff before I had developed the techniques.
Mm-hmm.
If anything I contributed, it was some new techniques with the brushes, only because of the tap dancers.
That's a great story. I mean, I know that when I saw this video, and I can't remember what it was, but you were using the brushes on a djembe.
Yeah.
And it was a combination of the brushes in your hand. And it was some of the most amazing music I've ever heard. It was incredible. It was fabulous.
Yeah. Well, yeah, thank you. And, you know, and it's kind of one of those things that it only happened because I loved what I was hearing so much.
Oh, man, that's the key. It's still the love.
Yeah. I wasn't going to be a tap dancer, but man, you know, the rhythms that they were doing, you know, and then it was all in time. It was never like,
yes,
you know, you can play some abstract stuff, you know, which is cool, you know, but these guys would play this stuff and it would have a groove to it and they'd be doing all kinds of things. And it was in time, you know, that really open up a Pandora's box of possibilities.
As a guitarist, I feel that way oftentimes when I hear flamenco players.
Right.
Because it's a way of life.
Right.
Some of the rhythms and combinations are just amazing.
Yeah.
So Clayton, I need to put a bow on this and wrap it up, but man, this has been a blast. I'm well aware that you're now part of the California Jazz Foundation.
Yes, I am.
But aside from that, what does the future hold for Clayton Cameron?
Yeah, well, you know, I have a few projects on the table. You know, COVID is a drag in terms of isolation, but isolation can be pretty cool if you're working on something that requires no one else's, you know, assistance.
Right.
So, as I mentioned, I'm finishing up a book that I started a while back called Perfect Time.
Mm-hmm.
It's a rhythm book for all musicians. It's not just for drummers or anything like that.
Wonderful.
I'm really excited about it because it just kind of does a lot of breaking down of things that are supposed to be so complicated, but I break them down to a point where they're, you know, very simple.
Mm-hmm.
I'm excited about that. So that's one thing. And then I just finished, I'll call it a COVID record with a group I call Collective Thinking.
Mm-hmm.
My friend named Johnny Valentino, guitarist and composer, we got together and just started recording on, you know, sending each other tracks, and then got other players like Jimmy Haslip to play on it.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's, you know, it's kind of a, it's some straight ahead in there, but it's also, you know, some more contemporary backbeat stuff, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of like some of the stuff that you saw, a couple of tunes where I'm playing brushes on djembe kit,
mm-hmm.
you know, that sort of thing. And so, you know, so it should be fun. I have a couple of live streaming things coming up. One on February 26th from the World Stage.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll be performing a couple of those tunes from that. And then last but not least, I'm pulling out a play that I wrote called Traps and Taps, A Brief History of Rhythm in America, which I performed a couple of times. One time, I think you probably saw it for California Jazz Foundation, one of the fundraisers I did with Chester Whitmore
mm-hmm.
at Catalina's. So Chester and I have been talking and just trying to bring that out again. And so when COVID allows us to get back together and people to, you know, come out, you know, trying to, you know, bring that back out again, but this time with the cast as opposed to just the two of us playing all eight characters. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so that's some of the stuff I'm working on.
Well, Clayton, again, thank you. It's been so much fun catching up with you. You know, one of my memories of us is you kicking my butt in tennis, but I'm not going to dwell on that.
You know, one thing I have to say is one time you were very generous to me. You had me come over to your studio and record a drum track.
Goodness, yes. Yeah, that was a few lifetimes ago.
Yeah, a few lifetimes. But I never forgot it because, you know, at that time I wasn't. You know, I was still getting my feet wet, trying to, you know, figure out what I could do and what I couldn't and work on stuff. And I always appreciated that you hired me to come over and just, you know, lay down a drum track.
That is the one thing I love about the performing arts. There's so much in it that it's about stewardship and it's about passing on to the next generation. And I know that for myself, you know, like, we talked about Henry Grant, and Henry was so instrumental in helping me out, as was Gil Askey, who helped you out. So yeah. This is the process. And now I'm teaching your son guitar. I mean,
yeah.
How great is that?
It's a big community.
It's a big community.
Know? Yeah, yeah.
And it has been a joy for me to do this podcast, and it's been a joy for me to interview you.
Well, Greg, thank you so much for doing this, man. I appreciate it. I hope I gave you something to work with.
Are you kidding? It's wonderful. So I'll get my editing chops together and I'll put something together and I think you'll enjoy it.
All right. Thank you so much.
All right. You take care.
All right. Take care.
All right, Clayton. Bye-bye. I got to tell you, that was so much fun. Okay. This Sonic Tonic episode could also be called the California Jazz Foundation episode because I'm on the board. Clayton Cameron is on the board. So I think it's only fitting that now you hear from the president of the board, Edith Bronston. Edie, take it away.
Thanks, Greg. This message is for every lover of the arts, and especially to our California jazz musicians who have had exponentially increasing stresses under the COVID-19 pandemic. The California Jazz Foundation is a nonprofit organization founded in 2006, committed to supporting California jazz musicians in crisis. We provide access to quality social and economic services for all eligible applicants. CJF has helped with rent and mortgage payments, housing relocation, arrangements for medical and dental care, in-home nursing, discount prescriptions, counseling, referrals to regional service agencies, and access to additional resources. We like to say that we take care of whatever is needed. So the bottom line is CJF stands ready to help if you are in need, a California resident, and have at least 5 years of primary employment as a jazz artist. For an application, contact the California Jazz Foundation hotline at 818-400-3263. That's 818-400-3263. Thank you.
Thank you, Edie. Okay, so I'm going to close it out with two gorgeous Clayton Cameron tunes. This first one is a beautiful ballad called The End of Our Winter. Oh, beautiful, 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 beautiful. Again, I want to thank you all for listening to Sonic Tonic. Please visit the California Jazz Foundation website at californiajazzfoundation.org and find out how you can help a musician in need. Okay, we're going to close it out with another Clayton Cameron song. It's a great straight-ahead jazz piece. It's driving, it's swinging. It's by Clayton Cameron. It's called Here's to the Messenger. And my guess is it's a tribute to Art Blakey of the Jazz Messengers.